On the program today, we will do some economic explaining. We will talk flowers as a business proposition. And we will go to the beach. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today, the third day of February. Good as always to have you along, everybody. You know, there are days, we try to keep them relatively few and far between on this program, but there are days when we got to do what are called process stories, how the economic sausage gets made, if I can mix my metaphors. The subject at hand is the Biden administration's plan to spend $1.9 trillion propping up this economy. The president told congressional Democrats today he is willing to compromise on some parts of it, but that he wants most of the money out and out fast, and that if they have to, Democrats in the White House are going to pass it themselves, that is, without Republicans. That would be using a process, there's that word again, that's called budget reconciliation. Marketplace's Mariel Segarra is on the explainer desk today.
To pass a bill in the House of Representatives, you need a majority of the vote. In the Senate, though, it's a little more complicated. Kelly Whitener is an associate professor at Georgetown.
The final vote on any piece of legislation does pass with a simple majority.
But under Senate rules, you can't get to that vote unless at least 60 senators agree to end debate.
And if you don't have the 60 votes, then members can filibuster and just, you know, offer lots of amendments, protract the debate, do anything really to stall and make it so you can't move forward.
Budget reconciliation is a way around all this. It's a process created in a 1974 budget law that allows senators to bring a bill to a vote with just a regular old majority. But they can't use it for just any bill. There are lots of rules, like it can't affect Social Security. And whatever they're trying to pass has to have a direct impact on the budget to cost money or save money. Bill Hoagland at the Bipartisan Policy Center says, for instance, sending out relief checks, that would qualify. Also,
any kind of tax reforms that have a tax impact would be included.
Case in point, Republicans used budget reconciliation to pass the 2017 tax overhaul law. And during the Obama administration, Democrats used it to pass a companion bill to the Affordable Care Act. Before that, during the Bush years, Republicans used it to pass tax cuts. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
All right, everybody, say it with me now. We're number what? 11. We're number 11. That's our spot in Bloomberg 11. It's our spot in Bloomberg's annual ranking of the most innovative countries in this global economy. And bad as falling outside the top 10 is, what's perhaps more concerning is that when Bloomberg began doing this index, we were actually number one, a spot right now occupied by South Korea. Marketplace's Scott Tong is on that one.
The Bloomberg Index finds that the U.S. is lagging in science, technology, engineering, and math graduates, advanced degrees, and workers in R&D. And all those are linked to the high cost of education here.
The U.S. could subsidize STEM degrees to a greater degree.
Alex Tanzi compiles the innovation rankings of Bloomberg. He says when the world's best and brightest do come study here, increasingly, they then leave.
There's been talk of when people get a PhD in the U.S., it should come with a green card. So there's policies like that that would induce people to stay in the U.S.
It also matters what trained workers do in this country. Youngjin Yu teaches digital innovation at Case Western Reserve University. He says big American companies hardly conduct long-term research anymore.
We are living off the innovations of 60s and 70s, you know, like, you know, Cold War. A lot of innovation activities going on now is like a consumer experience.
Consumer experiences with short-term payoff, he says, like social media.
I would almost argue that these are frivolous innovations.
Yu says the government should focus more on R&D and human capital, citing his native South Korea, which tops the Bloomberg rankings. There,
if you work for science and engineering R&D area, then you don't have to go to the military service for full length.
A lot of research suggests that innovation is the main driver of long-term economic growth. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Not a whole lot of innovating on Wall Street today. Kind of a wash, actually. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Shares of Amazon down about 2% today. Probably not on the Jeff Bezos news, though, because while he is not going to be the CEO starting this summer, Bezos is going to become the executive chairman of his company this summer, which means what exactly? Marketplace's Erica Barris has that one.
To find out what an executive chair even is, I reached out to Wharton professor Mary Hunter McDonnell. She says the executive chair is a strategic advisor to the CEO. The chair is also head of the company's board of directors, who the CEO is accountable to. McDonnell says becoming executive chair allows the former CEO to have a lot of say in the company's direction.
But also not be the person who's ultimately, you know, accountable for the strategic success or failures of the company going forward.
And since Jeff Bezos already owns millions of Amazon shares, he'll really have a lot of say in this role, says Matthew Slaughter, dean at the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth.
This is probably one of the most unique ones in terms of the chair, having been the founding CEO and also having such a large ownership stake in the organization.
The CEO to executive chair switch is called the apprenticeship model of succession. Bill Gates did it at Microsoft, Eric Schmidt at Google, Bob Iger at Disney. Sometimes the executive chair doubts moves the new CEO is making, says Robert Kelly, a management professor at Carnegie Mellon.
You start to then see power struggles between the current CEO, who might think that the executive chair is exerting too much influence or holding them back too much.
There can be battles for the board's favor and the new CEO's fate. But Kelly says since Bezos owns so much of Amazon, whatever he wants his chair will probably still happen. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
Our podcast, The Uncertain Hour, is back with its new season today, one that is especially topical given what the pandemic has done to the way we work. To be clear, work and what it means in this economy has been changing for going on decades now. The pandemic has just speeded it up. Same for what it means to be an employee, to get paid for your time. So in this time of gig work and side hustles, state and federal lawmakers and the Biden administration are going to have to figure that out, what it means to be an employee. So for a little background, Chrissy Clark, the host of The Uncertain Hour, starts their new season with a brief history of the word employee, where it comes from and why it matters.
There was a time not that long ago when there were no employees.
There were servants and there were artisans, independent laborers.
That's Richard Carlson, a professor at South Texas College of Law, Houston. He's written a lot about the origins of employment, and he says for centuries, paid work was divided into these two categories. You were either an independent artisan selling a skill in business for yourself, or you were a servant controlled by a master who paid you, who you knew and lived with, and who you were dependent on to earn a living. But by the mid-1800s, the Industrial Revolution had kicked into high gear. And a new kind of worker came on the scene. They worked in factories, coal mines, big industrial settings. They didn't know their bosses, and their work could be really, really dangerous. Richard grew up hearing a story about his grandfather that drives this point home. In the early 1900s, his grandfather got a job at a factory running a machine. After a few months,
the machine cut his finger off.
His grandfather found out it wasn't the first time that machine had cut off someone's finger, or the last. So why didn't the employer make this a safer machine?
And the answer is, why would I spend all that extra money? I can always just hire employees and cycle them through this process. And when a person loses their finger, I'll hire another one.
Because back then, it didn't cost the factory owner anything if a worker lost a finger. In the face of these industrial accidents, workers fought back. Eventually forced lawmakers to create worker protections, like workers' compensation laws. But as these laws were being written, there's this really basic question that comes up.
What do we call these people?
What word will properly capture all the people they think deserve these protections?
Lawmakers are struggling with the right word for this. Workmen, workers, hirelings, laborers.
Hireling was my favorite one.
Hireling. Yeah, that sounds so offensive.
Spoiler alert, hireling was not the word that was settled on. The word that was settled on was
employees.
derived from the term employ, which means to make use of something. In this case, companies are making use of the labor of a human being. But almost as soon as that word, employee, starts getting certain protections and rights attached to it, something starts to happen. One of the first times it happens is in the 19-teens in a coal mine in Pennsylvania, owned by a company called Lehigh Valley Coal. When, inevitably, one of their coal miners got hurt, he asked Lehigh Coal to help him, pointed to one of these new worker protection laws.
But Lehigh doesn't want to have to pay for those injuries.
And so Lehigh Coal says, actually, that law doesn't apply to the coal miners that get hurt in our coal mines because
these are not our employees. These people are just independent contractors. We simply grant them access to our coal, and they are their own supervisors. So their injuries are their problem, not ours.
The coal miner sued the company, and the guy who writes the opinion in the case is this influential judge named Learned Hand.
Who I think has perhaps the best name that any judge ever had. And he looks through this and he says, you know, these are the very people that we intended to protect with these laws.
The judge told the coal mining company,
these injuries happen on your watch, and therefore you should be liable for them.
Still, each time a new employment law has passed, creating a new worker protection, minimum wage and overtime, unemployment insurance, the right to form a union, there have been companies like Lehigh Valley Coal that say, well, if employers have to give this protection to employees,
perhaps we can avoid being an employer.
By telling their workers,
congratulations, you've just become entrepreneurs. You are now hereby our independent contractors.
And more than 100 years after Lehigh Coal, these battles still go on today over who is and who's not an employee. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
You are not going to want to miss the new season of The Uncertain Hour. Trust me on that one. It's available, of course, on the podcast platform of your choice. Coming up.
All of a sudden, when the waves are good, I sprained my ankle. I don't feel good.
Same here, man. Same here. But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, not a whole lot going on Wall Street today. As I said, Dow Industrials picked up 36 points, about a tenth percent, 30,723. The NASDAQ down 2 points. We'll call that basically flat. Finished at 13,610. The S&P 500, 4 points. Also, you know, flat 3,830. This month is the deadline for films to be considered for the Oscars, so a bunch of films, quote, for your consideration, are going to hit streaming services and, oh yeah, cinemas. Remember those this month? Latest box office report, by the by. Number one this past weekend, a noir film starring Denzel Washington called The Little Things brought in $4.7 million. A year ago, pre-COVID, that would have put it down in seventh place. Also down, bond prices, yield on the 10-year T-note, 1.13%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. One of the economic through lines of this pandemic has been how our spending has changed. We've talked about that a lot. We're going away from experiences and services, going out for dinner, travel, that kind of thing, toward more stuff, especially stuff you can buy online. For us today, right now on this program, that's flowers. Valentine's Day in a couple of weeks for those who have forgotten. Christina Stemble is the CEO of an online flower delivery company that she started. It's called Farm Girl Flowers. We talk to her every now and then. Hey, Christina, it's Kai. How are you?
Hi, good. Thanks for having me back, Kai.
Yeah, you bet. It's good to talk to you. You're rolling on your end, right?
Yes, rolling on my end.
All right, good.
All
so
ready to go.
Let's climb in on this thing. How we had you on in September. You'd gotten through what was supposed to be a slow summer. How did 2020 end for Farm Girl Flowers?
2020 ended phenomenally. I can't believe I'm saying that with 100% growth year over year.
Well, I'm sorry, 100% growth year on year?
Yeah, 100% growth. It was 40% higher than we were anticipating for the year. I can't believe we did that through COVID. So really happy with how it ended.
I wonder how much of that is people are buying stuff, that is flowers, instead of like services and travel and all that good stuff.
Yeah, I think a lot of it, I mean, we definitely benefited, and I feel really bad saying that when so many companies did not, but we benefited from just already being set up as an e-com company. And, you know, it was a big year for gifting because people couldn't be close to the ones that they loved. So they sent flowers and gifts instead. But I'm, you know, still definitely for hoping to get the vaccines in people's hands sooner, even if it means a negative impact for our company.
Of course, as are we all. Can we talk logistics for a second? Because you had to jump through no small number of hoops to get your product out to market in the middle of a pandemic. You got sick and there were workers. I mean, it was a whole big thing. Has that calmed down a little bit? You've put in protocols, I'm sure.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we're still spending a lot of money making sure we keep our team safely employed. We've added
like
more precautions even.
Like how much money are you spending?
Over $100,000 a month keeping our team safe. Yeah, it's a lot. Wow. What we do, bi-weekly testing. During the holidays, we did weekly testing. We're doing deep cleaning still. But we even added one more thing where a technical device that tracks people with who they're in contact with. So that way we can really identify, you know, when somebody tests positive, we can isolate it and get everybody quarantined that was around them.
Like inside your workflow, your warehouses and whatever, yeah?
Yeah, absolutely.
Did you get whacked at all by the whole shipping mess around Christmas? Because, I mean, you know, I had regular Amazon packages that were late, and it was fine if it was, you know, a light for my bike. But if it's cut flowers, I imagine that's a whole different deal.
Oh my goodness, we got it so bad. And it's my biggest fear for Valentine's Day, going into Valentine's Day right now. You know, we've had days when 100% of our packages weren't delivered, and we have to take financial responsibility for that. So going into Valentine's Day, when that potentially could be $12 million of flowers aren't delivered on time that we would have to reship at our expense. And so it's my biggest fear. It's what keeps me up at night. There's just a lot of it that's out of our control completely.
Yeah. So all of that's keeping you up at night. I wonder how much brain space you have to plan for your post-pandemic business, because at some point this is going to be over and you're going to be back to running an e-commerce business with perishable goods in a regular economy. Where are you on that?
Yeah, I'm a little nervous about that. definitely that takes a mental load up. I think like a lot of companies too, we're realizing, you know, as it was hard this year, like figuring out how to work remotely when we're, you know, manufacturing. But we found out that much of our team can work remotely. And just like, I think everybody else in the state of California, we're looking at like, you know, why are we here then? And, you know, the tax policies and all the things that are being implemented in California are really hard, especially when you have wage level team members and very low margin business. So, you know, we're looking at like, do we even stay in the state? We're looking at much bigger things, and we're getting bigger as a company. You know, this year we're looking at hopefully hitting $100 million in revenue. And so we're no longer going to be a small business. And so we really need to think about those things. And we want to make some profit that we can give back to our teams.
Did you imagine when you started this thing that you'd be looking at being a $100 million a year business?
I mean, I never had any idea that I could do that bootstrapped, to be quite honest. I thought we would have to raise capital, and I'm a little proud, I have to admit.
As well you should be. As well you should be. It's a company called Farm Girl Flowers. Christina Stemple founded it. She runs it. She probably does everything else in the middle, too. Christina, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thanks, Guy. It's great talking to you again.
Puerto Rico, I think you can fairly say, is an economy that's almost constantly recovering, especially in the last couple of years. Hurricane Maria hit in 2017. It flattened neighborhoods. It crippled the power grid, wound up being one of the most expensive natural disasters ever. And since then, Puerto Ricans have lived through political turmoil, a whole series of damaging earthquakes, and now, of course, the pandemic. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab spent some time on the island's west coast to see what it means to try to do business in an economy that can change like the weather.
It's winter in Puerto Rico, 80 degrees and sunny. And here in Isabela, winter is prime surfing season. Joel Torres is going over the basics with three beginner surfers on Hobos Beach.
Paddle, paddle, paddle. Con ánimo, hard, hard, hard. Gotta paddle hard. All right, chicken wing, arch, up.
Everyone pops up to their feet, a little wobbly on the first try. They practice that move over and over until the only thing left to do is to do it for real. So they wax their boards, put on their leg straps, and head across the sand into the crystal blue waves. Juan Ashton owns the surf school with his wife. He's a former pro surfer and Volcom rep. He convinced the brand to let him use its name for the business, called Volcom Presents Tropical Premium Surf School. It opened in August 2017, right in time for Hurricane Maria to rip Hobos Beach apart.
Oh my God, it was totally torn up. There was hardly any sand. It was like really rocky.
Puerto Rico was decimated. The storm cost billions in property damage. But the surf school's only infrastructure was a tent. Ashton got a late start building his business, and he knows it could have been a lot worse. The same is true with COVID. Business is actually booming.
Parents are like going crazy because they're like, Juan and Hannah, I got this kid 7 days a week in the house. Help me.
Ashton's biggest headache now is getting his surfing instructors to pick up extra hours because they like to surf too.
And all of a sudden, when the waves are good, I sprain my ankle. I don't feel good. Just all kinds of things.
Tourism makes up about 10% of Puerto Rico's GDP, but it's one of Isabela's main industries, and not just because of its beaches. There are mountains, caves, and forests. Craig Barker has been taking horseback riders through that terrain for 26 years. As business owners, he and his wife have been through a lot.
So much, politically, economically. Obviously, Maria was the most impactful thing in my life ever. That was the hardest thing I've ever done in my life.
Everyone here has a Maria story. Barker's includes 50 horses, no water for 2 months, and no electricity for 6. He says hurricanes, earthquakes, failing infrastructure, and now COVID.
All of this stuff has been tough. It'll tear you apart if you don't know, if you can't endure it. You have to be super, super tough.
Barker got a small PPP loan, and bookings at Tropical Trail Rides are only down a little because the business is outdoors. Actually, almost everything happens outdoors in Puerto Rico, but that's not enough to save every business. Javier Rodriguez Malpica owns a bar called Two Mojito. His specialty, of course, is mojitos in every flavor. Passion fruit, dragonberry, sesame. And they're 32 ounces, as big as a Big Gulp, for $8.
I'm a bartender that asks everybody, taste it, pruébalo. Check it out if you want more alcohol on it. You get drunk, I'm happy.
He's wearing a pretty thick mask, so if you couldn't make that out, he's saying he's happy to put more alcohol into your giant mojito. That's Bacardi, which is distilled in Puerto Rico. Rodriguez Malpica proudly tells me he's the 16th biggest buyer on the island, including hotels and Costco. When he lost power during Hurricane Maria, Bacardi sent him a generator so he could make ice. People from across the island came to his bar for a break from their troubles.
I think that was the boom of Mojito.
Now, Two Mojito has 20,000 followers on Facebook. The population of Isabela is just about 40,000. But popularity can't help him this time. The government has shut down bars during the pandemic. He's still running a small restaurant because they can stay open. And he drained his savings to convert Two Mojito into a second one. But he's been waiting months for the inspection.
The money I make today, I pay something. But no in the bank, no money. It's gone. And that's something that's scary right now. Lost everything.
He says if his bars can't open, he won't make it past summer.
Damn, Colby. I told my wife, this is my all-in. This is my last chance. My all-in. I put everything.
As I get up to leave, he asks me if other business owners nearly cry when I interview them. I don't have the heart to tell him how uneven the impact of this pandemic is, even in a place that looks like paradise. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, a very quick look at energy as hope springs eternal for an economic recovery this year. I hadn't checked crude oil in a while, till today. So imagine my surprise to see the U.S. benchmark West Texas Intermediate up above $55 a barrel, $55.69 a barrel to be precise. I kind of wonder if maybe I missed it because I'm not filling up the minivan as much as I used to. All right, we got to go, but here is your midweek moment of economic context, courtesy of the Federal Reserve and its Small Business Credit Survey, which is out today. Lots of really interesting data in there. For instance, 95% of small businesses in this economy, that is, companies with less than 500 employees, 95% of them said they have been hit by this pandemic. Here's one more item. Overall, 37% of small businesses say they had been able to get all the non-emergency financing they needed, that is, outside the relief packages. 37%, though, is not a whole lot of them, and it gets worse. Just 13% of Black-owned companies said they have been able to get their hands on all the capital that they needed. Think about that. Our media production team, once again, the people coming into the studio so the rest of us don't have to, is Robin Edgar, Garrett Lang, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Jay Seabold, Charlton Thorpe, Ben Tolliday, and Becca Weinman. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.